extreme radio for extreme times. This is A View from Space with the Spaceman on Talk Radio AM 640.
And this is A View from Space. I'd like to welcome you in if you're driving around town right now, or if you're at work listening to AM 640, checking out the show there. I welcome you in. Or if you're listening to me right now on Shaw Direct, channel 865, picking up the signal there, I welcome you in. If you're listening to me on your 3 or 4G personal communication device, rather, Stream the World software, I welcome you in. Or if you're what some call the best seat in the house, bar none, to check out A View from Space, logged on to 640toronto.com, picking up the live audio streaming there, I welcome you in. Wherever you are in the world, I welcome you in. You've heard me say it before. It will take 3 world wars to reach the desired goal of the elites that have it all planned. A one world government. We have to be complicit. 3 world wars will mold us, transform us into that mindset. We've had 2. The end game, of course, is to make you sick and tired of the horror that war really is. So that finally, in the end, you will accept. You will be so exhausted. You will be complicit. You will be so just totally separated from your feelings due to man's atrocities to his fellow man. And you will be ready to accept anything that will stop it, proposed by the authorities, of course, and that anything is this coming new world system that I speak about every week here on Talk Radio AM 640 on ABFS. But we're not there yet. We're not sick to the stomach of war yet. As a matter of fact, the Illuminati-controlled mass media portends exactly the opposite, that many people are and are gung-ho and behind everything their government officials do to get them into this conflagration that's coming deeper and deeper each day. That coveted goal of this cult now running our world, occupying all of its highest positions, is predicated on just one thing, and one thing alone that you've been shown over and over now in the Illuminati-controlled mass media lately, and that is the dead. Yes, the martyrs. The ones who had died for the cause in the past. They're the most valuable to the Illuminati's plans. Why? Because they're the ones used to make you feel as though you must retaliate, pay back the enemy, keep fighting, show them that you will not put up with their atrocities. For what? Well, you're never really explained that. It's always disguised as, well, we're bringing freedom and democracy to the rest of the world. Or, we're doing what's morally right. It's just the right thing to do. You're consistently being told that. But in some 25 odd years of hearing it and going along with it, haven't you noticed? There's been absolutely no change whatsoever, except for the situation to get even worse. With the Illuminati events that have been happening and the emotional buttons being pushed in most citizens of the Western world lately, that's really the dynamic directing the propaganda campaign underway, by the way. The Illuminati-controlled mass media has pounded away lately, daily, at your senses, at your feelings, your emotions, really in earnest since the 100th anniversary of World War I this past August of 2014. Yes, it's a slow but steady build-up. It started around then. If you'll recall, a grand spectacle was put on display, filling the world's media screens with images of past wars and threats of a war in the future. Then it shifted into high gear to sell the next world war to a global population that has already been depressed by grotesque examples of man's inhumanity to man, but not totally sick to the stomach of it yet. Then came the 13th anniversary, right on the heels of the World War I anniversary of the 100th anniversary. The 13th anniversary of the World Trade Center attacks. I bet you've never even recognized the fact that the heavy sell job, yes, sell job, heaped on you these past few months. I tell you, the build-up, the rah-rah cheerleading, the constant Illuminati events, one after another, that keep driving home the same message: war. I'm not done yet with the propaganda you've endured for the past 4 months. After the World War I 100th anniversary, the 9/11 13th anniversary, and World War I anniversaries, as well as World War II's commemoration at Dieppe, France, then a twisty turn happened in the propaganda onslaught. This war talk then shifted from out of the distance past World War I, World War II, and in the recent past, 9/11, 13th anniversary, it brought it into the now as ISIS. Yes, a word never, ever even uttered before by the Illuminati-controlled mass media, never heard of by the populace, unless you're a regular listener of ABFS, Talk Radio AM 640. This show, I talk about ISIS, the goddess, all the time. But back in April or May of this year, the word ISIS was totally unknown. ISIS is the vehicle to put this propaganda push into high gear. Soon after, a new label for the old threat of war, ISIS, was introduced to us. Just another excuse name, of course, for war, like the Mujahideen, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, take your pick. It's just a new label slapped on an old trick. Then we entered a new stage. I'll be back with that on the flip side of this break. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. This is ABFS. I'm the Spaceman, and I'm just getting started. I'm the guy that calls space. It's a View from Space, Talk Radio, AM 640. You can get to me through email only at space@640toronto.com or spaceman@640toronto.com. And thank you for the one that you sent. They start rolling in before this show even starts. Three world wars are planned before the world will accept a one-world government as the answer to everyone's problems. With their leader, the Antichrist, we've had two. The biggest propaganda push by far has started in 2014, selling the war. It really began, as I said earlier in my opening, the for the 100th anniversary of World War One this past August. And then a slowly but surely creeping buildup as it really started peaking and now basically has peaked right now. Of course, along with that, World War One 100th anniversary was the World War II commemoration. Also, we had the 13th anniversary of 9/11, all jam-packed into this very short few months. And a new twist after ISIS was introduced, which is the vehicle to put this propaganda push into high gear. It's just a new label on an old product. Mujahideen, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, whatever word you like. Then, as I said before the break, we entered a new stage. Really an old idea used in America in the aftermath of 9/11, if you'll recall. It was then the Illuminati events brought the war home to you. It wasn't something that's taking place far away in some foreign land across an ocean or two. No, it's now right at your front door. Homegrown terrorism is now the latest reason to get you into a war footing and mentally instructing you to be vigilant. Always be suspect. Remember, after 9/11, this was rampant in the Illuminati-controlled mass media in America. This now is really all for the Western world. Be vigilant. Always be suspect. Look for suspicious packages or people who make you curious or nervous. You know the drill. Now, after this weekend comes the biggest event, the mother of all memorial events, the biggest propaganda promotion of them all, Remembrance Day. Once again, the most valued weapon for war by the Illuminati are feted, the dead. And the ones still alive paraded about and deified, as well as the ones that have already passed. These are the ones who have died for the cause in the past. Anybody basically in a uniform really is now made a superstar by the Illuminati-controlled mass media propaganda machine. And the events leading up to this momentous Remembrance Day this year of 2014, I also need to mention this. The Gaza conflict in July, lasting 7 weeks. We've been on a constant diet of war footage going into our minds for the entire year. Syria conflict that has been going on since the early spring of 2011. And, of course, the Russian-Ukraine war, plus the Berlin Wall fall, the November 9th anniversary is coming up tomorrow, or if you're listening to me on the other side of the world right now, to AVFS, Talk Radio AM 640, it's already arrived. Conveniently positioned, wouldn't you agree? Just ahead of Remembrance Day, the fall of the Berlin Wall, where you have Gorbachev on the news coming out and saying, who was the Russian premier when they befriended the West and the wall came down, and I said at that point, mark my words, America will have Russia as its enemy. This is a ruse. Russia the bear is only sleeping and will awaken again. Well, she has awakened. So the Russian premier, former premier Gorbachev, who was around for Glasnost, remarked today that we were closer than we've been in a long time to another Cold War. Yes, there's that word again. War. See what I mean? Are you getting it yet? And then there's this. In the last few hours, the U.S. Marine that pretends that he shot Osama bin Laden, thrown into the Illuminati-controlled mass media once again. It is wall-to-wall war and death. We live in a death culture. War is glorified. It can be done now because most of the people, almost all of them, that saw the First World War and the Second World War are dead. Therefore, no one really knows the true horrors of war and can be sold romantically. And that's what we're going through today. But is it possible to actually sell a war to a population? Well, you and I already know the answer to that. It's an emphatic yes. I refer you to the father of all public relations and propaganda, Edward Bernays, an American whose ideas who've been taken and augmented by the information that the Tavistock Institute in London, England has garnered, and to this day are in action and being used on you, these methods to brainwash. Whether you know it or not, the most powerful ad men in the Western world are behind this push. Listen carefully to this. It's Edward Bernays explaining how such a small group, the Illuminati, could control the thoughts and minds of millions upon millions in order to sell a belief, sell a concept, sell an idea to a nation, or even nations, as is the case today. Here's Edward Bernays' words. The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society, the organized habits and opinions, constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. Edward Bernays. Someone is guiding your thoughts. The biggest tool of them all is the Illuminati-controlled mass media. The 21st century propaganda machine running in high gear right now, being used on you. It is the most sophisticated and persuasive and invasive propaganda machine this world has ever seen. The elite, that invisible government referred to by Edward Bernays, is the bloodline I talk about, whose octopus arms of influence reach into virtually every organization and government and corporation. It's a spell that's being cast on this culture of death, and guess what's being used as the symbol? The poppy, of course. And the poppy? From Morpheus. Morphine. Heroin, a dreaming, sleeping, narcotic drug. That's what the poppy is doing to the masses this weekend. Drugging the masses into this trance of going to war. We'll be right back. a spaceman. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. More follows this. I got to call space. It's View from Space on Talk Radio, AM 640. Emails to spaceman at 640toronto.com or space at 640toronto.com. Thanks for the one you sent. And I want to apologize to you right now, but I don't make a habit of reading emails that are flattering. It takes up time in the show where I could be talking of other things. So I hope you don't mind that. But I thank you so much for the ones that you have sent that have so much support behind them. Now, before I broke, I said that this elite bloodline, this invisible government Edward Bernays speaks about, that is actually behind the conscious and intelligent manipulation of your organized habits and your opinions. Well, most people's. I've got a feeling most people who listen to this show, well, almost all, don't feel that way. But this group is so powerful through its organizational apparatus, what I call the octopus, because it has arms of influence that reach into virtually every organization, every government around the world, and every corporation. Yale University may possibly be withholding America's most dangerous secrets. This elite, rich, funded Ivy League learning institution, as it's called, protects the interests of three of the most powerful secret societies in the world. They're the Skrull and Key, Wolf's Head, and of course the notorious Skull and Bones that I've spoken quite a bit about. These senior fraternities, as they're known, are the gatekeepers to the most powerful positions in politics and the world's largest corporations, particularly Skull and Bones. Oh, sure. In so-called democracy, those countries that have democratic systems, they claim, the Constitution places the people over the government and states or provinces equally. Everyone included. But that's not really what's happening. Consistently, the political societies make decisions to drop billions, no, trillions, into funding their own schemes, not the people's, to fulfill their own agenda. Dark secrets are kept between these powerful organizations like Skull and Bones, Skrull and Key, the Wolf's Head. By the way, Skull and Bones and Skrull and Key are the two main sources manipulating and guiding the entire planet toward a single government that they themselves called the New World Order. So you think history was an accidental phenomenon? Does anyone any longer realize the dangers of complacency? Because we have passively allowed the leaders to change our laws in every strata of our society to benefit the agenda of the elite rich, not the average guy, not the average woman who they claim to care so much about and want to help so much and are there to, and they always drag this word out, to serve. You're not serving anyone but your own interests if you're an elite. Yes. Does anyone realize the dangers of complacency? We've allowed them to make these changes that benefits them, not us. They've changed civil law. They've changed criminal law. They've changed corporate law big time. Financial law big time. And always, they tell us, we're told, for our own good. Personal freedom. Personal freedom must be vigilantly guarded by the citizen, you and I. And when any person in the position of power desires to take away even one of our personal freedoms, they must answer as to why it must be changed and how it's going to help us all. And must not imprison us or rob us of that personal freedom. Let me talk about the dead for a moment more. If we could bring them all back to life and showed them what kind of a world came out of what they paid for, the ultimate sacrifice, their life, and all we got were less freedoms and more of a police state, do you think they themselves would second guess why they did what they did and realize that they were duped into supporting a cause that was never really the truth? We as citizens have failed those martyrs that have come before in the First and Second World War and all of the small skirmishes. Miserably, we have failed them because we allowed them to take our personal freedoms away on an excuse that it was for our own good. No real answer to why it had to be changed or how it'll help us all. It's just for your own good. No, anyone that paid the ultimate price in the first two world wars will look at it and say, we saved democracy. But no, they didn't. We don't have democracy. We have corporate fascism. Yes, we citizens have failed miserably and let those martyrs down for what they sacrificed. To put it simply, we became non-vigilant, complacent, even lazy. And our biggest mistake has been implicitly trusting those positions and authority that are put there by those secret societies I just mentioned. You must realize dissent. Dissent is the highest form of patriotism. Once these people have taken away a personal freedom from you, you will never, ever get it back. And how about convenience? We've even let them change our money from cash to plastic, all in the name of convenience. Now, it's just a push of a button on your smartphone. All in the name of convenience. But all it really did was to put everyone in debt to the elite even deeper, who owned the banks. All because of its convenience, getting you to spend money you don't have. And buying the lie that going in debt is necessary. Why do you think they call it a convenience card? We allowed them to go from the gold standard to a fiat currency, money that's actually created by them out of thin air. The more you print, the less it's worth. Get the plan? Crash currencies. They've now printed and released so much fiat currency, it's become worthless paper. So the plan is to crash the currencies of the world at the correct time. Timing's everything. Politics and corporations use the media to navigate society. It affects the way we think and perceive things. Illuminati events manipulate global instability. As it skyrockets, the government spends the people's taxes to fund their war on terrorism, while the corporations are the recipients of that money, and still the politicians who supposedly represented you rammed it through government without a fight. No debates. And this carelessness. The average citizen's power to vigilantly guard is usurped totally. Gotten around. Taken away, rendered useless, vigilantly guarding. The truth is, we've already signed our fate. True democracy, dead a long time ago. There's no difference in any of the political parties. Whoever's put in power is placed there to fulfill the agenda of the elite rich. GPS devices are implanted in most automobiles, and now embedding tracking systems in children has raised discussion. Adults are next. We're headed toward that brave new world George Orwell outlined. Because that's the blueprint for it. 1984. Corporate fascism. There's a global campaign on to enforce that. And it will become the new world order. A predestined history written way back in 1832. Back with more on that. Talk radio, AM 640, I'm Space, this is AVFS. I'm the guy to call Space, it's View from Space. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. Emails too. They're just pounding it right now, filling my inbox. Spaceman at 640toronto.com or space at 640toronto.com. RG writes, if you put a frog in boiling water, it'll jump right out. If you put a frog in room temperature and slowly turn the heat up until boiling, its complacency at its finest as the frog stays in the water and gets boiled to death. It's how everything seems to be orchestrated for the masses. RG. BV writes from Hawaii. Fiat currency, usury, drowning us all. Why did Jesus overturn the moneylenders' tables in the temple? Just answer that one, all you Christians. And Harper was elected on a Christian platform. And the beat goes on, BV states. The secret society known as the Order of Skull and Bones is also known as the Brotherhood of Death. Wouldn't you know it? Most believe the society was the first ever at Yale U, but it's not. That's not true at all. If you actually research this subject, it's revealed that Phi Beta Kappa, established in 1780, was the actual predecessor of Skull and Bones, also known as Chapter 322, of course. That very occult number. As an aside to this, in numerology, the BBC, one of the biggest mouthpieces of Tavistock, the brainwashing capital of the world, is a reflection of that very number. The BBC, 322. A is the first letter. B is the second letter. And so on. So BBC actually forms, well, the two B's make two twos. The C is a three. The BBC forms a backward 322. The Order of the Skull and Bones was established by William Huntington Russell and Alfonso Taft, an American, in December of 1832, and as the second ever secret society. Phi Beta Kappa was Yale's first. It was formed on December 8th, 1779, 53 years before, yes, the Sun Worshipper's number 8, in that 53 years before. The Harvard administration became aware of Phi Beta Kappa's oath of silence and sent Edward Everett, Massachusetts Unitarian minister and Harvard's eventual future president, by the way, to lecture against the code of secrecy within colleges. He talked of true patriotism being undermined by it, also of mistrust and motivations for doing things and decisions being made in high offices in the land, which were filled by many Yale graduates. Everett's speech influenced many, including Phi Beta Kappa, because soon after, the secret society turned standard fraternity. So, William Huntington Russell started the Skull and Bones in response to Edward Everett's impact on Phi Beta Kappa. By the late 19th century, the most prestigious of these societies were the Skull and Bones, Skrull and Key, and Wolf's Head. William Huntington Russell was a descendant of several old New England families, including those of Pierpoint, as in John Pierpoint Morgan, Hooker Willett, Bingham, Russell. His ancestor, Reverend Noadiah Russell, was a founder and original trustee of Yale College, as a matter of fact. Ever heard of Charles Taze Russell? He was the one who started the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of the Jehovah Witnesses. He was a cousin of William Huntington Russell, who began the Masonic Order of the Skull and Bones. Another cousin of William Huntington Russell's, Samuel Russell, was responsible for a fortune being made in the United States opium smuggling trade in China. Speaking of poppies and that drug narcotic morphine, taken from Morpheus, of course, who put everyone to sleep. Samuel Russell's prosperity of the family wealth would be the funding agency overseeing the construction of the tomb. That's the secret meeting place, of course, the headquarters of Yale for the Skull and Bones. William Huntington Russell, and that Russell family was very powerful in those early years in the formation of America, returned to the U.S. after spending some time in Berlin, Germany, where he met regularly with a man called George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. He's the inventor of a routinely used formula today, by the way, pitting one side against the other to create chaos to bring about the desired change required. It's called simply problem-reaction-solution. It works very, very efficiently. It's a formula to manipulate the masses' opinions via the media. It's a black magic scientific method of achieving the Illuminati's goals of this one world government. Here's how it works. Very simple and effective. First, in order to achieve a solution that's required by the Illuminati, something they want to do, they want to put in place, they create a problem that will cause a reaction by the masses that will produce the desired solution they want to implement. Here's an example. Let's say you want to ban guns. I often bring that one up. So confiscating all the guns is the solution you require, but in order to achieve that, you must create the problem first. In this case, you flood the streets with guns. You don't ban them. You flood the streets with guns. What happens next is there's too many shootings, too many armed robberies, too many innocent bystanders being gunned down. So you implement the solution you wanted in the first place, and that was to get rid of all the guns, because the people will be crying out to take the guns off of the streets. It's called problem reaction solution. From the mind of one George Hegel. Hegel was a Bavarian, the Illuminati bloodline I talk about, and this theory dominated Bavaria during those years when William Russell was studying there. During his day, he was involved with a corrupt Bavarian leader of an underground organization who held death as their insignia. That's why we have a death culture. Look who's running the show. This society was none other than the apocalyptic order of Bavarian Illuminati, whose sole purpose for existence is to create a predetermined synthesis, meaning a combination of often diverse conceptions into a coherent whole of their own making and design, where the state is absolute, and the people that live inside that state, the individuals, are granted independence based on their obedience to the state. The state, of course, meaning the New World Order. That is an insight, a quick glimpse into the future system that is coming and coming hard. Lucifer behind it all, the light bearer, a strange and mysterious name to give the spirit of darkness, isn't it? Lucifer, the son of the morning. Is it he who bears the light? And with its splendors, intolerable, blinds, feeble, sensual, or selfish souls? Doubt it not! That was the quote taken from Albert Pike's book Morals and Dogma of the Ancient and Accepted Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. Lucifer, the dark side. Even our coffee now. We have a company that was Canadian a long time ago. Now an American company, and then now recently just sold to Brazil, Tim Hortons. Dark Roast, it's called. Come over to the dark side. Everything is selling you on dark. And it's coming from the light bearer. What a revelation. From the first degree, the first initiation, the Mason is urged mightily to seek the light. The average Mason is continually saying that he is seeking the light and will spend his entire life moving toward the light. Almost every person in Western civilization will assume that this light is the revelation of the God of the Bible, but this statement is held up continuously to try to convince you that Masonry is Christian. Yet here, Albert Pike is saying that Lucifer is the one who bears the light of Freemasonry. Lucifer is the light bearer of Freemasonry. Pike's sentence immediately before this one confirms not only that Lucifer is the light bearer, but that Masons of previous degrees have been led to believe that the opposite was true. Stairway to Heaven. Sometimes words have two meanings. The apocalypse is to those who receive the 19th degree. the apotheosis of that sublime faith which aspires to God alone and despises all the pomps and works of Lucifer. Since the wording is a little arcane, understood only by those who have the special knowledge, at first glance this sentence seems to contradict the one I first quoted where Pike identifies Lucifer as the Masonic light-bearer. But when you understand the esoteric explanation, your understanding clears up completely. More on the other side of the break. It's Talk Radio, AM 640, I'm Space. Well, I got a call, Space. You can email me, spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. Thanks for the one that you sent me. I really appreciate it. JL writes, Space, it's a little hard to live in these times around people who are too busy reacting. It's, of course, driven by the Illuminati-controlled mass media pushing their emotional buttons. You get struck down and ridiculed when you say, I don't believe what they're telling me. Like the Ottawa Parliament Hill shooter. All it takes is one guy inspired by a website to change policy, and nobody seems to find this convenient. I seem like I'm repeating myself with a lot of people, telling them you cannot wage a war against a military superpower with lone wolf shooters inspired by propaganda. If things really happen this way, then why doesn't anyone here take over China from within, shooting up malls because a website told them to? I also cannot forget to mention the new rhetoric, the ISS magic ghost plane, formerly Flight 370, that Malaysian airliner that went missing, possibly armed later with nuclear weapons that can fly across the world undetected to bomb America. JL ends off the email with, this is the land of confusion. Well, I'm here to clear up the confusion, if I'm able. So, let me just say, Albert Pike gives concrete evidence of Freemasonry's worship of Satan, Lucifer, on the very front of the cover of his book, Morals and Dogma. Below the round seal of God, Pike writes a phrase written in Latin, which proves to be a typical satanic phrase. One look at this phrase would alert any Satanist that the contents of that book are satanic. A Satanist would also understand immediately that all of Freemasonry is, in fact, satanic. What is the phrase, you ask? Deus mimque jus. The literal meaning? God and my right. It's a very typical one with Satanism. It has two meanings, of course. Sometimes words have two meanings, one within the other. First, this phrase means that the Freemason can depend upon their God to determine their right and justice. Secondly, since the God of Freemasonry is Lucifer, Masons are saying that they are using occult methods through Lucifer to achieve the rights and justice. This phrase is very powerful and very dangerous within Satanism. The second a Satanist sees this phrase in Latin on Pike's book, he knows the material within is Satanism without even reading a single word. Here's more. Quote, the day has come when fellow craftsmen must know and apply their knowledge. The lost key to their grade is the mastery of emotion, which places the energy of the universe at their disposal. Man can only expect to be entrusted with great power by proving his ability to use it constructively and selflessly. When the Mason learns that the key to the warrior on the block is the proper application of the dynamo of living power, he has learned the mystery of this craft. The seething energies of Lucifer are in his hands, and before he may step onward and upward, he must prove his ability to properly apply energy. He must follow in the footsteps of his forefather, Tubal Cain, who with the mighty strength of the war god hammered his sword into a plowshare, written by Manly P. Hall, 33rd degree Mason, a Knight of Tabor. They're named after Mount Tabor, by the way, in ancient Palestine. It became the stronghold of the Knights of Tabor. The book is many is the Lost Keys of Freemasonry, by the way, or the Secret of Hiram Abiff. It's believed by many Christians that Mount Tabor was the site of the transfiguration of Jesus on the mountain. Jesus begins to shine with bright rays of light. The prophets Moses and Elijah appear next to him, and he speaks with them. Jesus is then called Son by a voice in the sky, assumed to be, of course, God the Father. This transfiguration is one of the miracles of Jesus and the Gospels in the King James Version of the Bible. This miracle is unique among others that appear in the canonical Gospels in that the miracle happens to Jesus himself. The statement is the most bold and concise anyone can create in the English language. It boldly states that once the Mason learns to control his emotion and to properly apply the dynamo of living power, he can be assured of being able to control the seething energies of Lucifer in his hands. What's more, he admits that Masonry is the craft, which is the ancient name, the old name for witchcraft. What's more, all Satanists are assured that if they will join the coven and learn the craft, that individual will control the supernatural power of Satan, just as Manly P. Hall has stated. This is the most powerful proof that Masonry worships Satan, because its language is direct. Its language is clear, not cluttered with deliberately confusing arcane language that only an insider could understand. And to understand that Manly P. Hall and Reynold Blight are both 33rd degree Masons, while the illustrator of Manly's book, The Lost Keys of Freemasonry, was a 32nd degree member. McCoy Publishing Company, by the way, is also one of the most famous of all Masonic publishing companies putting the book out. But the revelations from this quote are not finished yet. Notice that Hall, Manly P. Hall, makes reference to Tubal Cain. That, on the other side of the break, it's Talk Radio, AM 640. It's just AVFS. I'm the Spaceman. Back with more in a minute. I'm the guy they call Space. A View from Space on Talk Radio, AM 640. Tubal Cain. Of course, the last name tells you what bloodline he belonged to. Cain, of course, the half-man, half-god tribe that was conceived by Adam and Eve? No. By Samael and Eve, Satan and Eve, Lucifer and Eve. So who was Tubal Cain? The answer is, he was the Vulcan of the pagans. The answer is given in William Peterson's Masonic Quiz Book, Ask Me, Brother. It's also found in John Yarker's The Arcane Schools, a review of their origin and antiquity, with a general history of Masonry and its relation to the theosophic, scientific, and philosophic mysteries. In fact, in the third degree of Masons, Tubal Cain is the password given. Tubal Cain, of course, is the insignia spelling out 007. Tubal. Two balls, two circles. And the cane. And of course, as you know, a cane is shaped much like a seven. A handle. And of course, the length of the stick. Tubal. 0000. The cane. The seven. 007. Tubal Cain. But in the third degree of Master Mason, learning level, that's also the password given. Other than identifying Freemasonry with paganism in this sentence, what is the meaning of the Vulcan of the pagans? This question is very important because Manly P. Hall states once again, the Mason has the seething energies of Lucifer in his hands. He is to walk in Tubal Cain's footsteps. And Hall makes it sound like Tubal Cain is one of the Greek gods. And we know for sure that Tubal Cain is indeed the Vulcan of the pagans. So just who is this Vulcan of the pagans then? Vulcan, a sun deity, who is associated with fire, thunderbolts, and light. The festival in honor of him was called the Vulcania, in which human sacrifices, of course, were offered burnt. He is described as being a man with family relationships to the Christian devil. It's fascinating to know that he married Venus, another name for Lucifer, the female version of the devil. Wow. So Manly P. Hall tells the Mason that he can have the seething energies of Lucifer in his hands, and then tells him to follow in the footsteps of the Christian devil to whom human sacrifices are offered. It can't be stated more clearly than that, can it? Baphomet clearly displays several archetypal and mysterious symbols throughout its overall devilish appearance. For example, it carries the sign of the pentagram on its forehead, the mark of the beast, where above it is seen a solar torch, of which Eliphas Levi, the one who drew the Baphomet image, commented saying that the flame of intelligence shining between his horns is as the magical light of Lucifer himself. Looking in even deeper into this, you could notice that one arm of Baphomet is actually female, the other is male, like those of the divine Androgyn. Both sexes in one form. Its hands forming the sign of Hermeticism, one pointing up to the white moon of Chesed, the other pointing down to the black one of Gibura, mimicking the phrase, as it is above, so it is below. Medieval astrologers saw within Baphomet the conjunction of the moon and Venus, or the sun and the moon, united in tantric eclipse, while alchemists saw the sun and moon in union of transmutation, ethereal with material. And the pagans believed it to be their sun god merging with the moon goddess. Sex is basically at the crux. The symbol that's pictured meditating was actually first published in 1659 as an illustration for the book Azoth of the Philosophers by the legendary German alchemist Basil Valentine. The word Azoth in the title is one of the more arcane or secret names for the one thing. The A and Z in the word relate to the Greek Alpha and Omega, of course, the beginning and the end of all things. The word is meant to embrace the full meaning of the one thing, which is both the chaotic first matter at the beginning of the work and the perfected stone at its conclusion. At the center of this image, the face of a bearded alchemist at the beginning of the work, like looking into a mirror. This is where the adept fixes his or her attention to meditate on the mandala. Within the downward pointing triangle superimposed over the face of the alchemist is the goal of the work, the divine man, in which the forces from above and below have come together. Each of the numbered points on the star emanating from the alchemist stands for an operation in the emerald formula: calcination, dissolution, separation, conjunction, fermentation, distillation, and finally coagulation, and contains the writing for the corresponding metals. The alchemist's schematized body is the offspring of the marriage between Sol, the archetypal sun king, seated on a lion on a hill to his right, and Luna, the archetypal moon queen, seated on a great fish to its left. Its father, of course, is the sun, its mother, the moon. The laughing, extroverted sun king holds a scepter and a shield, indicating his authority and strength over the rational, visible world. But the fiery dragon of his rejected unconscious waits in a cave beneath him, ready to attack should he become too arrogant. The sad, introverted moon queen then holds the reins to a great fish, symbolizing her control of those same hidden forces that threaten the king. And behold, behind her is a chaff of wheat, which stands for her connection to fertility, of course, and growth. The bough she cradles in her left arm is actually a bow and arrow, symbolizing the wounds of the heart and body that she accepts as part of her existence. Put simply, the king and queen represent the raw materials of our experience, our thoughts and feelings, with which the alchemist works to mold. I mention the alchemist simply because this world is under the influence of these alchemists, who are now transforming, changing our world into something that we never ever thought would be. The king symbolizes the power of thought, ultimately the one mind of the highest spirit. The queen stands for the influence of feelings and emotions, which are ultimately the chaotic one thing of the greater soul. The much anticipated marriage of the king and queen produces a state of consciousness best described as a feeling intellect, which can be raised, purified, to produce a state of perfect intuition. All obscurity will be then clear to you when you reach this state of mind from your Gnostic climb, your knowledgeable climb to become a god. It is the glory of the whole universe. You see, the Illuminati believe that knowledge, through knowledge and what you know, can make you a god. It's made them our gods here on Earth. The knowledge they possess, The goal of alchemy is to make this golden moment permanent in a state of consciousness called the Philosopher's Stone, everlasting life. And it all starts with the marriage of opposites within us. Well, that is what we're told. The body of the alchemist is made up of four elements. His feet protrude from behind the central emblem. One is on the earth, and the other one's in water. In his right hand is a torch of fire, and his left a feather. It symbolizes air. Between his legs dangles the cubic stone labeled with the words corpus, meaning body. The five stars surrounding it indicates that it also contains the hidden fifth element, the invisible quintessence, whose inherent strength is perfected if it is turned into earth. Where the head of the alchemist should be, there's a strange winged caricature that's variously interpreted as a heart, a helmet, or even a pineal gland at the center of the brain. The symbol evolved from the winged disc of Akhenaten and became the top of the caduceus, that magic wand of Hermes, who's now the medical profession's symbol, where opposing energies merge to produce miracles. That's what the caduceus and Hermes meant it for, to be. The knob at the top represents the ascended essence, the essence of our souls raised to the highest level of the body, to the brain, where it becomes a mobile center of consciousness, able to leave the body then and travel to other dimensions. You have become God, and you can astral travel. I'm a spaceman. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. More next. Emails, too, and I communicate by email only. Spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. No Twitter account. No Facebook. No net presence. I don't have a cell phone. Small, tiny cyber footprint. Baphomet depicts the implicit acceptance of the cosmic laws. This symbol, known as Baphomet, was originally used by the Knights Templar, the forerunners to today's Freemasonry, to represent Satan. Among other names given to this infamous and most powerful symbol, Baphomet is also known as the Goat of Mendes. This potent symbol depicts the forces of the powers of darkness combined with the fertility of the goat. As Satanism embraces the carnal side of man, the pentagram of Baphomet is depicted in a reverse position to appear as the head of a goat, its horns representing duality. The three other points are inverted as to represent the Trinity denied. The Hebrew symbolism found around the figure originates from the Kabbalah, and it spells Leviathan, the serpent of the watery abyss, and is aligned in definition with that which is called Satan. One of the most prominent of magical symbols, Baphomet, or the Goat of Mendes, also known as, is depicted with two breasts, two half-moons defining the symbols of Hecate, the dark aspect of the moon goddess. The artist who drew it all up in the beginning, Eliphas Levi, who designed the most infamous rendition of Baphomet, said that the sketch represented the sum total of the universe's intelligence, the four elements, divine revelation, sex and motherhood, and sin and redemption. You need to know that the image does not represent an actual demon. It's a symbolic representation of a hidden faith. It encapsulates the essence of Satanism, the accuser sitting in judgment of the world and imitating the true God with both a masculine and feminine facade. It's both the devil and the whore of Babylon in one. Satanists, both past and present, believe it to be Satan and his whore of Babylon, the woman riding the beast. Clearly, there's an alchemical union of powerful cosmic duality represented there, a union which brings about something else entirely. The child of ascension. Now, the emerald formula. Ever heard of the emerald formula? It's a seven-stepped process taken from the precepts of the emerald tablet that became the basis of all alchemists' experiments. Remember, emeralds, green. Green is Satan's favorite color. He hid in the foliage to beguile, trick, and finally lord over Eve in the Garden of Eden. Although the alchemists went to painstaking trouble to conceal the true order of the steps of this formula, this emerald formula taken from the precepts of the emerald tablet, went to painstaking trouble to conceal that true order. The correct order, according to the emerald tablet, is calcination, dissolution, separation, conjunction, fermentation, distillation, and finally coagulation. These are the steps the world is going through right now. And these are the steps that man goes through to become God. Calcination is the first of seven major operations. Of course it would be seven steps. The number of spirituality in the alchemy of transformation from a mortal man into a god. Man becomes God. And you thought that tablet you were using to do all your work on was just a word that, well, someone came up with to describe the rectangle with the screen on it. No, it's taken directly from the emerald tablet. That was the first tablet the world ever saw, describing the seven major operations in the alchemy of transformation of a mortal man into a god. Because your tablet that you tap today with your fingers is making you, well, empowered. A closer step to becoming a god. With everything at your fingertips, and you just simply touch and it appears magically on your tablet. Chemically, the calcination process involves the first step, man becoming God, involves a healing, a substance in a crucible or over an open flame until it's reduced to just ashes. In the Arcanum experiment, calcination is represented by sulfuric acid, which the alchemist makes from a naturally occurring substance called the vitriol. Now, sulfuric acid is a powerful corrosive that eats away flesh, human flesh, and reacts with all metals except one, gold. psychologically, this is the destruction of ego and our attachments to material possessions. Calcination is usually a natural humbling process as we're gradually assaulted and overcome by the trials and tribulations of life, though it can be a deliberate surrender of our inherent pride or self-conscious gain through a variety of spiritual disciplines that, well, ignite the fire of introspection and self-evaluation. Physiologically, the fire of calcination can be experienced as the metabolic discipline or aerobic activity that tunes the body, burning off excesses from overindulgence and producing a lean, mean fighting machine of a person. Calcination begins in the base or lead chakra in the sacral cup at the base of the spine. In society, the calcination is expressed in the lives of revolutionaries, conquerors, and other warriors who try to overthrow the status quo. On the planetary level, it's the fire of creation, the formation of a livable Earth. On the planetary level, it's that livable environment from molten matter and volcanic ash. According to the Emerald Tablet, its father is the sun. Its element is, of course, fire. Its colors, magenta, purple, and red. All the colors you would find in a flickering flame. Dissolution is the second major operation or step in the alchemy of transformation from man to God. And you can put it the same way as they're transforming this earth. Chemically, it's the dissolution is the dissolving the ashes from calcination in water. In the Arcanum experiment, dissolution is represented by iron oxide or rust, which shows the potentially corrosive powers of water on even the hardest of metals. Rust will eventually eat through the thickest and toughest metals made. When it's processed, vitriol breaks down into sulfuric acid and iron oxide, which are the first two arcana or secret ingredients. The Egyptians smelted iron as far back as 1500 before Christ and used iron compounds as tonics and as disinfectants. The iron ore conglomerate mining giant Rio Tinto has been around since the time of the Phoenicians, who counted the bloodline of Cain as members, by the way. And that company, Rio Tinto, has never left the family. After all, Tubal Cain was the first blacksmith. He invented smelting, fashioning weapons out of metal. Psychologically, this represents a further breaking down of the artificial structures of the psyche by total immersion into the unconscious, non-rational, feminine or rejected parts of our minds. It is mostly an unconscious process in which our conscious minds let go of control to allow the surfacing of buried material. It's opening the floodgates and generating new energy from the waters held back. Dissolution can be experienced as a flow, the bliss of being well used and actively engaged in creative acts without traditional prejudices, like personal hang-ups or established hierarchy getting in the way. Physiologically, dissolution is the continuance of the Kundalini experience, the opening up of energy channels in the body to recharge and elevate every single cell. dissolution takes place in the genital or tin chakra and involves the lungs and spleen. Now, in society, this process of steady growth through gradual dissolution is showcased by an agricultural or, say, a monistic-based lifestyle. On the planetary level, dissolution is the great flood for the Earth, the cleansing of the Earth of all that's inferior. Its mother, the Moon, its element, water, its color, light blue, just like the water. Separation is the third operation of transformation in alchemy. That, when I return on Talk Radio AM 640, it's AVFS. I'm the guy I call Space. Back with more in just a minute. I'm the guy they call Space. This is A View from Space, Talk Radio AM 640. Emails to spaceman at 640toronto.com or space at 640toronto.com. Thank you for the one that you've sent. I really appreciate them. I really do. I do not read flattering emails. And the other email that I do not read are the ones that ask me to keep the information to myself on what they tell me. And I just want to acknowledge, DG, I've received your information, and I will adhere to your request not to read it on the air. And I thank you so much for that very pertinent, intimate information given. So I was saying before the break, dissolution, the second major operation in the alchemy of transformation, because you see, not only is the man being transformed as we speak today, the earth is, society is being transformed. I spoke about this quite a bit during the Sochi Winter Olympics. And the heat, the hot, cold, and the signs were everywhere on the Sochi premises. Hot, cold. The constant heating and cooling, bending and shaping, the transformation of the world. So dissolution, the second major operation. Chemically, it is the dissolving of the ashes from the calcination in water in the Arcanum experiment, taken from the emerald tablet. Dissolution is represented by iron oxide or rust, which shows the potentially corrosive powers of water even on the most strongest metals. That's representing the breakdown of the artificial structures of the physical by total immersion in the unconscious, non-rational part of our minds. Separation follows dissolution. Separation is the third of the operations of transformation in alchemy. What I mean by transformations in alchemy is man becoming God. The earth become a one standalone unit in unto itself. Separation, the third of the operations of the transformation. Chemically, it's the isolation of the compounds, the components of dissolution by filtration, and then discarding any ungenuine or unworthy material. In the Arcanum experiment, separation is represented by the compound sodium carbonate, which separates out of water and appears as white soda ash on dry lake beds. I'm sure you've seen it. We call them salt flats. The oldest known deposits are in Egypt. The alchemists sometimes referred to this compound as natron, which meant the common tendency in all salts to form solid bodies. Natron. Psychologically, though, this process is the rediscovery of our essence and the reclaiming of dream and visionary gold previously rejected by the masculine rational part of our minds. It is mostly a conscious process where we review formerly hidden material and decide what to discard and what to reintegrate into our refined personality. What we discard and what we bring with us and keep. A lot of the shadowy material are things we're ashamed of, or we're taught to hide away from our parents, or hide from our church, or hide from our school authorities. Separation is letting go of the self-inflicted restraints to our true nature so we can shine through. Physiologically, separation is followed and controlled breathing in the body as it works with the forces of spirit and soul to give birth to a new energy and a physical renewal. Separation begins in the navel or iron chakra, located at the level of the solar plexus, around your stomach area. In society, in our world, separation is expressed as the establishment of families, cities, and nationalities. You separate one group from another, because later you can pit one of those against the other to make the transformation. Society separation is expressed as the establishment of a family system, city system, nationalities. Separation on the planetary level is represented by the formation of land masses and islands from the powerful forces of air, water, earth, and fire. The wind it carries in its belly, its element, air, its color, orange-red. Conjunction. Well, that's the next step, the fourth step of the seven operations of transforming a man into God, or this earth into a one-world government through alchemy. Hot and cold. Chemically, it is the recombination of the saved in elements from separation into a new substance. In the Arcanum experiment, conjunction is symbolized by a nitrate compound we call cubic saltpeter or potassium nitrate, which the alchemists called natron or simply salt. Blue-colored natron acid, aqua fortis, as it's known, was made by mixing potassium nitrate and sulfuric acid and was used to separate silver from gold, for example. The inert residue that comes from the acid during the reaction, like a child being born. Something comes of it. Psychologically, it's empowerment of our true selves, the union of both the masculine and feminine sides of our personalities into a new belief system or an intuitive state of consciousness. The alchemists liken it as the lesser stone. And after it is achieved, the adept, the craftsman, is able to clearly discern what needs to be done to achieve lasting enlightenment, which is union with the over-self. Supposedly often, synchronicities begin to occur that confirm that alchemists are on the right track. Physiologically, conjunction, the fourth of the seven operations of turning a man into God, is using the body's sexual energies for personal transformation. Conjunction takes place in the body at the level of the heart or copper chakra, as it's known. In society, this is the growth of crafts and technology to master the environment. Going deeper, it means growth of power by using magic spells and using technology to control the masses. Exactly how I started the show this evening, with the propaganda machine, the greatest propaganda machine ever devised in the history of man, the Illuminati-controlled mass media, which is today very hard at work transforming our world. To master the environment, yes, harness the wind? Forget that. That was done a long time ago. How about manipulating the weather through chemtrailing? It's being done today. On the planetary level, this conjunction occurs when primordial life forms are created from the energy of the sun or lightning. The earth is its nurse. Its element, earth. Color? Green, of course. Fermentation. That's the fifth operation in the alchemy of transformation. Fermentation is a two-step process, really, that begins with the decomposition of organic matter from the hermaphroditic child, from the conjunction resulting in death and resurrection to a new level of being. The fermentation phase then begins with the introduction of new life into the product of conjunction to strengthen it and ensure its survival. Chemically, fermentation is the growth of a ferment, bacteria, in organic solutions, right? This is what occurs in the fermenting of milk to produce curds or cheese, or in the fermenting of grapes to make your wine. In the Arcanum experiment, the process of fermentation is represented by a compound called liquor hepatis, which is an oily, reddish-brown kind of mixture of ammonia and the rotten egg-smelling compound hydrogen sulfide. Egyptian alchemists made ammonia by heating camel dung in sealed containers and thought of it as kind of a refined mercury that embodied the life force. Liquor hepatis means liquor of the liver, which they believed was the seat of the soul, and the color they associated with the compound was green. Color of bile. That's really strange, because the fact that liquor hepatis actually gives off a wonderful fragrance, and the alchemists made a perfume of it even called balsam of the soul. What does fermentation mean psychologically? That on the other side of this break on Talk Radio AM 640. Save the FS. I'm Space. Back with more in a minute. The guy that calls Space, this is a View from Space. It's Talk Radio AM 640. Thank you so much for your email. I really appreciate it. I really do. I'm going through the seven steps of which man becomes God in alchemy. The transformation of a mortal man into a man who became a god. And the earth, of course, is going through the same process, a transformation into a new entity. I'm at the fifth operation of the seven steps in alchemy of transformation, fermentation. The two-step process that begins with the decomposition of organic matter and the fermentation phase then begins with the introduction of a new life into the product. as you take wine, say, for example, ferment the grapes, it turns into something else. In the Arcanum experiment, the process of fermentation is represented by a compound called liquor hepatis that I talked about earlier. Psychologically, fermentation process starts with the inspiration of spiritual power from above that reanimates, energizes, and enlightens the alchemist. Out of the blackness of his decomposition of organic matter comes the yellow ferment, which appears like a golden wax flowing out of the foul matter of the soul. Its arrival is announced by a brilliant display of colors and meaningful visions called the peacock's tail. Fermentation is achieved through different activities that include intense prayer, desire for mystical union, breakthrough of the personality, transpersonal therapy, psychedelic drugs, deep meditation, and fermentation is also known as the living inspiration from something totally beyond us. Physiologically, this process, this fermentation, is the rousing of living energy, or chai, or the kundalini, in the body to heal and rebuild. It's expressed as vibratory tones and spoken truths emerging from the throat of Mercury chakra, the messenger. In society, this process, this fermentation experience, is the basis for religion. It's the basis for mystical awareness. And on the planetary level, it's the evolution of life to produce higher consciousness. During fermentation, your consciousness is raised from the darkness of the animal body through personal meditation and planetary evolution. Separate the earth from fire. It's represented by the substance sulfur. The color is turquoise. The planet's Venus, and its metal is Mercury. The sixth major operation in man becoming God, transforming the earth into a one-world government, distillation. Chemically, it's the boiling and condensation of the fermented solution that happened in step five to increase its purity, such as that takes place in the distilling of wine to make brandy, for instance. In the Arcanum experiment, the emerald tablet, distillation is represented by a compound known as black pulvis solaris, which is made by mixing black antimony with purified sulfur. The two immediately clump together to make what the alchemists call a bezoar, a kind of refined solid that forms in the intestines and in the brain. Distillation is the agitation and refining of psychic forces, which supposedly necessary to ensure that no impurities from the inflated ego or deeply submerged identity are incorporated into the next and final stage, where man becomes God. Personal distillation is made up of a variety of introspective techniques that raise the content of the psyche to the highest possible level. Free from sentimentality and emotions, cut off even from your personal identity, distillation is the purification of the unborn self. All that we can truly be and eventually are when the process is finished. I get the feeling that Steve Jobs lived this to the nth degree. Now, physiologically, distillation is raising the life force, repeatedly from the lower regions of the cauldron of the body to the brain. What Oriental alchemists called the circulation of the light, where it eventually becomes a wondrous, solidifying light full of power. Distillation is said to culminate in the third eye area of the forehead, at the level of the pituitary or pineal glands, in the brow or the silver chakra, as it's called, your forehead. In society, the distillation experience, this sixth major operation of alchemy, of transformation, is showcased as science and experiments. On the planetary level, this distillation is the realization of the power of higher love, as the life force of the entire planet gradually seeks to become one force in nature, based on a shared vision of truth. All must be one. During the distillation process, it rises from earth to where else? Heaven, and descends again back to earth, thereby combining within itself the powers of both the above and the below. Its substance is Mercury, its color deep blue, its planet Mercury, its metal, of course, silver. Silver, of course, the very first Olympic medal for first place, originally silver, then gold, was moved into that category. Coagulation. We've reached the seventh and final operation of alchemy. After this, you supposedly become a god. After this, the earth presumably becomes one. Chemically, coagulation is the secreted substance of the purified ferment from distillation. In the Arcanum experiment, coagulation is represented by a compound called red pulvis solaris. This is the seventh and final operation in alchemy, changing a man into God. This red pulvis solaris is a reddish-orange powder of pure sulfur mixed with the therapeutic mercury compound, red mercuric oxide it's called. The name pulvis solaris actually means powder of the sun, and the alchemists believed it could instantly perfect any substance to which it was added. Get where all this is leading to? The sun is God, pure and simple. Back with more right after the break on Talk Radio AM 640 on this final seventh operation to turn man into God. I'm the guy that calls space. This is a View from Space. It's Talk Radio AM 640. Emails too. Communicate by email only. Space at 640toronto.com or spaceman at 640toronto.com. I've been going through the Emerald formula taken from the precepts of the Emerald Tablet are the basis of all alchemists' experiments to bring about a god. Man becomes God. There are seven steps. They begin with calcination, then dissolution, then separation, then conjunction, then fermentation, distillation, and finally, where I've taken us to the final and seventh step, coagulation. It's first sensed as a new confidence that is beyond all things psychologically, coagulation, though many experience it as a second body of golden coalesced light, a permanent vehicle of consciousness that embodies the highest aspirations and evolution of mind. I believe, as I mentioned earlier, last segment, that Steve Jobs lived this to the nth degree. Coagulation incarnates and releases the ultima materia, as they call it, of the soul, the astral body, which the alchemists also refer to as the greater or philosopher's stone. Using this magical stone, the alchemists believed that they could exist on all levels of reality. Yes, chemically, coagulation is the secreted substance of the purified ferment of distillation. And is represented by a compound called red pulvis solaris. The exact translation of that is, the sun is God, powder of the sun. Now, coagulation, being the final step in man becoming a god, or the earth becoming this final entity, this one global unit, physiologically the stage is marked by the release of the elixir in the blood, and that rejuvenates the body into a perfect vessel of health. A brain ambrosia is said to be released through the interaction of light from the phallic-shaped pineal gland and matter from the vulva of the pituitary. This heavenly food both nourishes and energizes the cells without any waste products being produced whatsoever. These psychological and physiological processes create the second body, a body of solid light that emerges through the crown or gold chakra. This is comparable to the Eucharist sustenance, a Christian given who's in danger of death. In society, it's the living wisdom in which everyone exists within the same light of evolved consciousness and knowledge of truth. On a planetary level, coagulation is a return to the Garden of Eden. This time on a higher level, in tune with the divine mind. You know, I spent almost an hour and a half giving you the seven steps. Well, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young reflected it all in the hit song Woodstock, written by Joni Mitchell. We gotta get back to the garden. That's a line in the song. On the planetary level, coagulation is a return to the Garden of Eden. Well, you know the words too. Woodstock, I'm sure. Refresh your memory. Well, I came upon a child of God. He was walking along the road of life, right? And asked him, tell me, where are you going? This he told me. He said, I'm going down to Yasker's farm, going to join in our rock and roll band. Got to get back to the land and set my soul free. We are stardust. We are golden. We are billion-year-old carbon. And we've got to get ourselves back to the garden. Well then, can I roam beside you? I have come to lose the smog. I feel myself a cog in something turning. And maybe it's the time of year. Yes, said maybe it's the time of man. And I don't know who I am, but life is for learning. We are stardust. We're golden. We're a billion-year-old carbon. And we've got to get ourselves back to the garden. By the time we got to Woodstock, we were 500,000 strong, and everywhere was song and celebration. And I dreamed I saw the bomber jet planes riding shotgun in the sky, turning into butterflies above our nation. We're stardust. We're golden. We caught in the devil's bargain. And we got to get ourselves back to the garden. According to the Emerald Tablet, this is how you will obtain the glory. According to the Emerald Tablet. Glory of the whole universe. You will attain the whole universe. All obscurity will be clear to you. This is the greatest force of all powers because it overcomes every subtle thing and penetrates every solid thing. Its substance, of course, salt, as in the salt of the earth. Used when you describe a person who's beyond reproach. A god. Its color violet, purple, the royal color. Its planet, the sun, of course, sun is god. Its metal, of course, the metal with the color of the sun, gold. The first four steps take place below in the realm of matter, in this evolution, this transformation of man, mortal man, to a god. The last three steps take place above, in the realm of mind and imagination. This is graphically depicted by the way as a snake in its tail, in its mouth, in a shape of an eight. The sun worshippers, number the eight, the top circle of the eight formed by the snake is the above, and the lower circle of the eight is the below. So what the occultist says is reflected in the eight shape formed by the snake. As it is above, so it is below. In the Middle Ages, Baphomet was believed to be an idol represented by a human skull. I talked about it earlier, the drawing, Eliphas Levi. And it's of keen importance, represented by a human skull. The crusading Knight Templars, who were thought to worship this demonic effigy as the source of fertility and wealth, later admitted by the younger Templars that they had been instructed by elder Templars to worship the idol as their only god and their savior, and that the elders anointed the image of the beast with the fat of murdered children. In 1307, King Philip IV of France accused the Knights Templar order of satanic heresy, even lewd immorality, demonic ceremonial magic, and ritualistic rites in which they practiced spitting on the crucifix, sodomy, blood sacrifice, and more. Concrete evidence of Baphomet-like creatures being found in many Templar cathedrals spanning Europe. Every one akin to hermaphroditic devils. Probably the best known representation of Baphomet, as I've already stated, on AVFS, Talk Radio AM 640, is the drawing by the 19th century French magician Eliphas Levi, whose Baphomet has a goat's head, human trunk with a round female breast, a caduceus in the midriff, human arms and hands, split hooves for feet, demonic wings with a pentagram placed in the center of its forehead, and a torch on the top of the skull between its horns. Eliphas Levi combined elements of the tarot devil, of the tarot card deck, where a naked man and woman are bound in chains to Satan, and the goat worshipped in antiquity in Mendes, Egypt, which was said to fornicate with its women followers, as the devil was reputed to do with witches. Which only strengthens the point that Baphomet and its torch is actually the representation of satanic carnal knowledge, maybe even of the evil bloodline of Cain. Just as the pagan fires of Beltane to this day have their connection to the celebration of carnal wisdom, the knowledge of good and evil, as it was called in Genesis. The witchcraft historian Montague Summers suggests that Baphomet was, in actual fact, a combination of the Greek baph and metis, meaning absorption of knowledge. The midriff also gives a clue to the real identity of Baphomet. It's covered in reptilian-like scales, like a dragon. Like a crocodile that was worshipped in ancient Egypt. In the Arcanum of Magic, it's declared that he controls the soul who controls the blood of another. Ceremonial magic is the ancient art of invoking and controlling spirits by a scientific application of certain formulae. A magician enveloped in sanctified clothing and carrying a wand inscribed with hieroglyphic figures could, by the power vested in certain words and symbols, control the invisible inhabitants of the elements and of the astral world, while the elaborate ceremonial magic of antiquity was not necessarily evil. What came from its perversion were several false schools of sorcery and black magic that is practiced on you and I today. Space back and more. Flip side of this break on Talk Radio, AM 640. This is AVFS. Well, I got a call. Space. This is a View from Space. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. Emails to spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. Egypt, a great center of learning and the birthplace of many arts and sciences. Well, that was an ideal environment for transcendental experimentation. Here the black magicians of Atlantis continued to exercise their superhuman powers until they had completely undermined and corrupted the morals of the primitive mysteries by establishing a priestly caste to create fear, and therefore, through the fear, gain control of the masses that they usurped, the position formerly occupied by the initiates. This new priestly caste seized the control of the spiritual government. So black magic dictated the state religion and paralyzed the intellectual and spiritual activities of the individual by demanding his complete and unhesitating compliance demanded by the priestcraft. This is exactly where this globe is headed again. The pharaoh then became a puppet in the hands of the Scarlet Council, just as today our kings and our queens, our prime ministers and our presidents and our premiers, all are puppets in the hands of the Scarlet Council. Who are they? A committee of arch sorcerers. I call them the druids, elevated to power by the priesthood. I believe this is exactly what's happening in our world today. The leaders of all the countries are the pharaohs, And the Scarlet Council is the Illuminati with today's modern-day highest-placed druids as the sorcerers laying out the plans and the method of how to implement them with the maximum success achieved. Yes. Arts and sciences that can control and create fear. It's being used on you and I today. And we are right in the midst of the greatest of these, the mother of all, the commemoration events, Remembrance Day with the poppy as its symbol, the dreaming, hypnotic, narcotic, morphine, heroin, keeping the masses perpetually stoned. These sorcerers then began the systematic destruction of all keys to the ancient wisdom, so that none might have access to the knowledge necessary to reach adeptship without first becoming one of their order. They mutilated the rituals of the mysteries while professing to preserve them. So they're doing this with the what's called God's living word here on the earth, so that even the thought which you're entitled, even the thought you're escaped. Idolatry introduced by encouraging the worship of the images, which in the beginning the wise had erected solely as symbols for study and meditation. False interpretations were given to the emblems and the figures of the mysteries, and elaborate theologies were created, conjured up to confuse the minds of the devotees. The masses were, of course, deprived of their birthright of understanding and groveling in ignorance, eventually becoming the abject slaves of the spiritual impostors. Superstition universally prevailed, and the black magicians completely capitalized and dominated in national affairs, with the result that humanity still suffers from the, well, the ways of the priestcrafts of ancient Atlantis in Egypt, because it's carried on today and it's being used against us today in a much more refined and much more focused way. Fully convinced that their scriptures sanctioned it, many medieval Kabbalists actually devoted their lives to the practice of ceremonial magic. That transcendentalism of the Kabbalists was founded upon the ancient and magical formula of King Solomon, who has, well, since antiquity been considered by the Jews as the prince of ceremonial magicians. Among the Kabbalists of the Middle Ages were a huge number of black magicians who strayed from the concepts of Sefer Yetzirah and became enmeshed in demonism and in witchcraft. They've tried to substitute magic mirrors, consecrated daggers, circles spread around posts on coffin nails, for the living of that virtuous life which without the assistance of complicated rituals or submundane creatures only brings man to the state of true individual completion. You might be a young person listening to me right now, or someone who's old and tried to go where I just talked of. This should be a warning to you that anyone else who's seriously thinking of delving deep into the occult for magical powers, it's no place for you. Those who wanted to control elemental spirits through ceremonial magic did it with the hope of securing from the invisible worlds either rare knowledge or supernatural power. And the little red demon of Napoleon Bonaparte and the infamous ocular heads of the de' Medici family are examples of that disastrous result of permitting Satan worshiping people to dictate the course of advancement for the human race. And are we there in such a big way? This really proves that the intellectual and moral status of the magician has a lot to do with the type of chemical mixture he's capable of invoking. But, if you'll recall, even the demon of Socrates deserted the philosopher when the sentence of death was passed. Transcendentalism and all forms of magic are just blind alleys, spin-offs of Atlantean sorcery, and those who forsake the straight path of philosophy to wander there always fall victim to their quality of their state of being. Man is incapable of controlling his own appetites and is not equal to the task of governing the fiery and tempestuous elemental spirits. He gets, well, ragdolled by the demons every time. Many a magician has lost his life as the result of opening a way whereby submundane creatures, spirits from the netherworld, could become active in his or her life. When Eliphas Levi invoked the spirit of Apollyonus of Tanya, what did he hope to accomplish? Is the gratification of curiosity a motive sufficient to warrant the devotion of an entire lifetime to a dangerous and unprofitable search? If the living Apollyonus refused to divulge his secrets to the profane, is there any probability that after death he would disclose them to the curious-minded? Think about it. Eliphas Levi himself didn't dare to assert that the specter which appeared to him was actually the great philosopher, because Eliphas Levi probably realized only too well that the talent of the demons contacted by him could very easily impersonate those who have passed on. Familiar spirits, they're called. The majority of modern mediumistic apparitions are but demonic creatures masquerading through bodies composed of thought substance, only supplied by the very persons desiring to behold these wraiths of these bodiless beings. More next on Talk Radio AM 640. This is the Spaceman and AVFS. This is AVFS, a view from space, Talk Radio, AM 640. I'm the Spaceman. This is the final segment in tonight's show. The theory and practice of black magic. Some understanding of the intricate theory and practice of ceremonial magic can be found if you know what the purpose of magic is. Do you know what the purpose of magic is? I talk about magic quite often and different types. Ceremonial magic, which is ritual. And then there is also lesser magic, without ritual, which is what's happening most times on the Illuminati-controlled mass media, on the so-called news stories that you watch. That's lesser magic. What is magic, though? The purpose of magic is, first, the visible universe has an invisible counterpart. The higher planes, of which are peopled by good and beautiful spirits. The lower planes, dark and foreboding, are the habitation of evil spirits and demons under the leadership of the fallen angel and his 10 princes. Second, the purpose of magic. By means of the secret processes of ceremonial magic, it's possible to contact these invisible creatures, gain their help in some human undertaking. They will then disguise themselves as good spirits, willing to lend their assistance to any worthy enterprise, only to seduce you later. And the evil spirits serve only those who live to pervert and destroy. The third purpose of magic is, it's possible to make contracts with spirits, whereby the magician becomes, for a stipulated time, the master of a demon. Many of those contracts you'll find in the music world. The fourth purpose of magic, true black magic, is performed with the aid of a demonic spirit who serves the sorcerer for the length of his earthly life, with the understanding that after death, the magician shall become the servant of his own demon. For this reason, a black magician will go to inconceivable ends to prolong his physical life, since there is nothing for him beyond the grave. The most dangerous form of black magic is the scientific perversion of occult power for the gratification of personal desire. It's less complex and more universal form is human selfishness. Selfishness is the fundamental cause of all worldly evil. A man will barter his eternal soul for temporal power, temporary power. And down through the ages, a mysterious process has been evoked which actually enables him to make this exchange. In its various branches, the black art includes nearly all forms of ceremonial magic, necromancy, witchcraft, sorcery, vampirism. Also included are mesmerism and hypnotism. Though the demonism in the Middle Ages seems to have disappeared, there's a boatload of evidence that in many forms of modern thought, especially the so-called prosperity philosophy, you know, the willpower-building metaphysics, the systems of high-pressure salesmanship, you hear them come on all the time on late-night television with the power of the mind. Black magic has merely passed through a metamorphosis. Although its name may be changed, its true nature, exactly the same. A well-known magician in the Middle Ages was Dr. Johannes Faustus, more commonly known as Dr. Faust, of course. I'm sure there is no one listening that knows or has never heard of, does not know or has never heard of Dr. Faust. By a study of magical writings, he was enabled to bind to his service an elemental who served him for many years in various capacities. Strange legends are told concerning the magical powers possessed by this Dr. Faust. On one particular occasion, the philosopher, apparently in a playful mood, throws his mantle over a few eggs in a market woman's basket, causing them to hatch instantly. At another time, having fallen overboard from a small boat, he was picked up and returned to the craft with his clothes still dry. But like nearly all other magicians, Dr. Faust finally came to disaster. He was found one morning with a knife in his back, and it was commonly believed that his familiar spirit, the one that had served him most of his life, this elemental, had murdered him. Although the author, Goethe's Dr. Faust, is supposedly seen as just a fictional character, this old magician actually lived during the 16th century. Dr. Faust even wrote a book describing his experiences with spirits. Here's a small little excerpt from Dr. Faust's book. While the black magician at the time of signing his pact with the elemental demons may be fully convinced that he is strong enough to control indefinitely the powers placed at his disposal, he is speedily undeceived. Before many years elapse, he must turn all of his energies into the problem of self-preservation, a world of horrors to which he has attuned himself by his own covetous looms nearer every day, until he exits upon the edge of a seething maelstrom, expecting momentarily to be sucked down into its turbid depths, afraid to die because he will become the servant of his own demon. He knows this. The magician commits crime after crime to prolong his wretched earthly existence. Realizing that life is maintained by the aid of a mysterious universal life force, which is the common property of all creatures, the black magician often becomes an occult vampire, stealing this energy from others. According to medieval superstition, black magicians turned themselves into werewolves and roamed the earth at night, attacking defenseless victims for the life force contained in their blood. The black magician often becomes an occult vampire, stealing energy from others. I just described to you what government is. It steals the energies, in this case, money and the will of the people, and controls it themselves. You see how alchemy figures heavily into today's transformation of this world. That's why the governments are now so invasive. They are the vampires, keeping the elite alive on Earth for as long as they can, with as much power as they can wield, because they have nothing left but the grave. The black magician cannot use the symbols of white magic without bringing down upon himself the forces of white magic, which would be fatal to his schemes. So he must therefore distort the histograms so that they typify the occult fact that he himself is distorting the principles for which the symbols themselves stand. Black magic is not a fundamental art, it's the misuse of an art. So it has no symbols of its own. It merely takes the emblematic figures of white magic and, by inverting, reversing, signifies that it is left-handed. Black magic is the left-handed path. Black magic is used to hurt, harm, destroy. white magic is the right hand to heal, to grow. Both come from the same source, a satanic source. A good instance of this practice is found in the pentagram. It's a five-pointed star made up of five connected lines. This figure is the time-honored symbol of the magical arts and signifies the five properties of the great magical agent, the five senses of man, the five elements of nature, the five extremities of the human body. By means of the pentagram with its own soul, man not only may master and govern all other creatures inferior to himself, but he may demand consideration at the hands of those superior to himself. The pentagram is heavily used in magic, but when so used, its form always differs in one of three ways. The star might be broken at one point by not permitting the converging lines to touch. It might be inverted by having one point down and two up. Or it may be distorted even by having the points of varying lengths. When used in this black magic sense, the pentagram is also called the sign of the cloven hoof or the footprint of the devil. The star, with two points upwards, is also called the goat of Mendes, because the inverted star is the same shape as a goat's head. When the upper right star turns and the upper point falls to the bottom, it signifies the fall of the morning star. Of course, there is an agreement or deal that has to be agreed upon by the magician and the demon in the performing of ceremonial art aided by that demon. In the case of black magic, it's the magician and not the demon who must sign the pact. When the black magician blinds an elemental to his service, when he captures that spirit, he signs with his own blood. And at the end of his life knows that that demon becomes his god. Until then, all the power the demon possesses is wielded by the black magician. That's our Illuminati of today running this world. Now you could possibly fully understand why we're where we are. This has been A View from Space on Talk Radio, AM 640. Coast to coast, next time, space, and I'm out.
Streaming live at 640toronto.com. John Oakley in the morning and Bill Carroll in the afternoon. It's time to talk about it. This is Talk Radio, AM 640, CFMJ, a Chorus Entertainment Company. This is AM 640.